is for us in this piece of the Kriduwa. We have celebrated them at St. John's Seminary, and they were a great resource for us of grace. And I must say, the way in which it changes the entire vision and the affectivity of people in relationship to God first and then to one another. So we come from that experience to the time that you have here. I'm not quite aware of all the history of your getting together right after Easter, but it seems to me to be a wonderful way of continuing to be able to contemplate and to participate in the graces of the mysteries that we are just celebrating. The issue of the year of faith comes to us, as you well know, in relationship to really a lifetime of work that Pope Benedict has undertaken and has made available to us through his writings and through his remarkable person. And he builds into this a recognition and relationship to Blessed John Paul II's work on the new evangelization, and has, of course, established the new Council for Evangelization, which, when we had our ad limina visit this past November, we were able to meet with Archbishop Kella and to listen in on the beginnings of the way in which the Council itself is beginning to establish things. And the realization of the fact that we are living in the West in a culture that is so bereft of any sense of God in any way whatsoever, and bereft really of the availability of... Yes, see, this is what happens. One doesn't remember everything. I'm not even sure if I know what to do. Okay. So, but it's bereft of a whole series of other institutions that are needed, and have been related to Christian faith over the centuries, which in fact really is the establishment of a culture which has able to shape civil society in a way that has a certain openness to the mystery of God. I always used to be amazed at the way in which the Jewish comedians could provide a sense of a sense of mystery, even though they themselves may have had no direct experience of it. I think of someone like Woody Allen, for example, who always has this great sense about the tension. The humor in Allen and so many of those Jewish comedians was always found in the tension between the absolute and the immediate. And he had oftentimes some of his greatest punchlines come in the framework of questions that link these two together in ways that have absolutely nothing to do with one another and become startling. For example, he once talked about he would like to believe in God, and he just hoped that God would do something good for him, like deposit $500,000 in a Swiss bank account. Or how can you think about God when I have my tongue got caught in the roller of my electric typewriter this week? So you have these silly kinds of things, but which open up a sense that there is something that is absolute and transcendent that, in a certain sense, makes everything else that we do incomplete, inadequate, and indeed, in some sense, foolish. The importance that we have in this year of faith, which is basically connected, as you well know, to the beginning of the Second Vatican Council, and also to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which was released in 1992, makes clear to us the way in which the Church has, in a sense, been preparing for something along the line of what we have in relationship to this matter of faith as the mystery which lies at the very heart and core of the whole of Christian existence. And the difficulty about this matter that I think we need to consider a bit today is the complication of the relationship between the fact that that faith is a gift, and yet at the same time, faith is also an undertaking and a work. And that there is a way in which the scriptures provide for us a powerful sense of the way in which the movement toward faith is a movement that oftentimes begins in the ordinary questions that human people ask about the meaning and purpose of their lives. These questions are not necessarily immediately religious. These questions are oftentimes provoked by a certain dissonance that comes into people's lives by what they have received as a type of cultural response to the world as it surrounds them. And I think there is no greater model of that reality than the account of the story of the faith of Abraham. Because in that story we have the need to recognize and to remember what the cultural context was in which Abraham moves, at the same time is drawn. So this matter of the movement of the questions, the wonder, the sense of wonder that comes into play concerning the purpose of his life when he's living within a cosmogonic world in which everything is completely frozen. Everything is fated. And the thing that is most important is the recognition within Abraham that there is something missing that he senses within the interiority of his own life and his own heart and his own desires. And it's because of this kind of opening of a question that Abraham's soul is in a search for what it might be that is the truth about his existence. In the cosmogonic world, which had been set up through the whole of the ancient East, the principal work was to imitate the cycles of the cosmos in the structure of the ordinary life of organizing human experiences. And therefore, immediately what we know is what was cut off were those dimensions of the human self which had to do with an authentic development of human intelligence and understanding, and also, of course, the limitation upon human liberty and the ability of freedom to be exercised in a way that would move one out of the fatedness that had been a part of that cosmogonic structure. And I think we can see this as the whole story of faith moves through the book of Genesis. This matter of the struggle from out of this culture that was the controlling and dominant voice that had been the way in which life was ordered by the political and also the economic, and also all of the family structures and so forth that were a part of that ancient world. I think this is an important lesson for us as we begin to think about this year of faith in terms of the fact of what is it that we actually face as we begin to try to allow this awakening and this opening of people's hearts to a rediscovery of the mystery of the infinite love of God. Because the cultural setup is, in effect, the basic, what I call, the base, you're taking it from, of course, the Greeks, it's the basic paideia in which every single person is shaped. And that shaping is given through all kinds of symbols and signs and narratives and images that are part of the society, which in a sense seeks to create a fundamental anthropology that is starkly contradictory, just as starkly contradictory as the cosmogonic vision of the human self was at the time of Abraham. Now let's think a little bit about the Abraham story and how it moves forward into the conclusion of the book of Genesis in the story of Joseph and his brothers, which was one of the most remarkable accounts of the way in which gift, faith as gift, and Joseph's whole life as a representation of the reality of gift as constitutive of all basic structures of human existence. But back to Abraham. Abraham, of course, wonders whether or not the awakening of his soul is something that only he has come to know. And it's within the framework of that question of wonder about, is there someone with whom he can speak? Can he testify to what has happened in him? Is there any way that there are others that can testify back to him that, yes, indeed, this is something that is truthful about our existence as humans? And in that context, he receives the promise that there will be a whole people, and that he is to be the father of that people, and that therefore he is the one to be the guide and to be able to lead them to the recognition of the God he has come to know, and the God who begins to speak in a way to him about the protection and the care and the watchfulness and the providence. And so he's called to sacrifice his son Isaac, the first one who would seem to be the beginning of that promise, who would seem to be the one who would fulfill the begin, the start, the fulfillment of what had been told to him about there will be a great nation. And he's called to bring to sacrifice Isaac, and so he goes to bring him to where, of course, cosmogonic sacrifices would have been made on the tops of mountains. Bless you. And so he prepares, he brings everything but the lamb to be sacrificed. And in the process of this, he fulfills something that is simultaneously strange to him and yet familiar. Because in the cosmogonic world, the way in which one would give any honor to the cosmic deities was to sacrifice the firstborn. This would have been part of the cultural system. So Abraham certainly would have known this. And yet the promise had made the great change in what the custom of the cosmogonic world should have been contradicting the cosmogonic world, because the promise certainly did that. But he follows through on the matter of the obedience of what he has heard God say to him, called him to do. And in that great moment in which Abraham's faith leads him to a situation in which it may appear as if nothing has changed. We're still in the same old thing. We destroy life in order to give thanks. And it's in that moment when he is stopped that the work of the promise begins its power. And Abraham retrieves the goat from the hedges, sacrifices the goat. Now, what is there important about that the lesson that's being taught in that? It would seem this, that one of the things that faith immediately requires, because it is a gift, it requires acts of gratitude. gratitude for this awakening, gratitude for this sense of the human subject as being brought into a unity and intimacy with God that allows the human person to become aware of some inkling as to what its true destiny is. And in that process, we see that you cannot eliminate the importance of the gratitude. Cosmogonic vision of the gratitude would have to change, of course. But the act of gratitude was the element that allowed faith to continue and to grow. And this is one of the great difficulties, I think, that we have to address in our modern context. There is no gratitude left. And that's why the soul continually gets shriveled up. There's no sense that we owe anything to anybody, but especially not to God. And this matter then of the gratitude becomes central. It's a law of the gift. It's how the gift always works. We'll say a little bit more of that later. But before we do that, I want to talk with you a little bit about how the extension of this tension between the cosmogonic culture and the faith that is now being mediated in the hearts and minds of the people who become Israel. And that is in the Joseph story, where we hear about the fact that Joseph receives two gifts. He receives from his father the gift of his coat, and he receives from God the gift of the dream. And he brings these two gifts to his brothers, and the brothers despise him because of these gifts. Why would they despise him so much? Is because the whole cosmogonic system is being thrown out of control, because primogeniture is no longer operating. The gift should be going to the eldest son. Why is it going to the second youngest son? Because the gift comes wherever there is an opening. Wherever there is an opening, the gift is capable of coming into existence. And Joseph, first thing he does, he tells his brothers about the dream. He testifies, "I dreamed a dream." And as you remember, he tells them about both dreams. And the more he tells them, and by the time of the second dream, when he talks about the fact that their sheaves are bending over in the wind and his stands upright, and they have the cosmogonic interpretation of that, of course. You're going to lord it over us? So gift is looked upon as some kind of an extrinsic power to dominate. Libido dominandi. And in that context, of course, we hear the story about how Joseph is removed from their midst and sent off, imprisoned, interprets. He becomes not only a dreamer, but he becomes an interpreter of dreams. He has some test interpretations that he makes for his fellow prisoners, who then testify about him. And then he's brought before the Pharaoh, because the priest of the Pharaoh, the cosmogonic priest, cannot interpret the Pharaoh's dream about the fatted and the emaciated calves. And then Joseph is remembered and brought forward. And in that context, you can see what the difference between the impossibility of the cosmogonic, why the cosmogonic priest cannot interpret the Pharaoh's dream. Because the Pharaoh's dream is about gifts and the proper use of gifts. They don't know about gifts. They know only about cycles of repetition. And within the cycles of repetition, there is really no need for any kind of response to a gift or gratitude or preparation. What does one do when one has received so much? And that's what Joseph understands. He understands the way in which gifts actually carry life. You never waste the abundance of God's bounty. You save it, because there may come a day when you will not have the same amount of bounty, the same amount of gift every day, every year. And so the practical, historical, economic response that comes out of Joseph's faith is one of the remarkable things in that whole story. It changes the situation of life and death. It changes the situation of the entire structure of the culture. And it changes, of course, the most important thing. It changes the brothers' relationship to the one they have sold away. So when the brothers come down the first time, we go through that whole situation in which he recognizes them. They don't recognize him. He negotiates with them because he basically wants to see Benjamin and to learn about his father, who had given him the coat. And so the negotiation goes forward. And then what he does when they come, because if they come again, if they need grain, they have to bring Benjamin with them or they won't receive anything. And when they come, of course, he recognizes them again and he sets up a dinner for them. And he places each of them right next to each other in terms of their age, which means Benjamin sits next to him. And he has the dinner, and they make the negotiations. And then he gives the great test. The great test is the cup, the Pharaoh's cup in Benjamin's sack. This is not only a test about his brothers, it's a test about Joseph himself. And you can see that in the way in which he responds to the brothers after Judah comes back with Benjamin has the cup, of course. And what is the question of, obviously, that Joseph has? Would they do to Benjamin what they did to me? In other words, there's a very interesting question about, has there been any sense of an awakening that has changed his brothers? Is there something there that would be a different thing? Maybe they wouldn't have sold him now. And when Judah comes forward to stand in for Benjamin and gives his reason that his father has already lost a son, and were he to lose another one, he would die, his heart would break. And it's only when that moment, when someone can give something of themselves to transform what has been set up by Joseph as a way to determine whether or not a transformation has occurred in them, that he can reveal himself to them. And his revelation to them is a revelation which is basically a desire to embrace them, to forgive them. This is the mutuality that faith begins to achieve within the framework of its meeting faith in others. This, in a sense, is a prototype of the church. This matter of Joseph's ability to bring his brothers to him, to forgive them. And then there is, you remember, toward the end, after his father comes down and the whole family is now together in Egypt, there's this marvelous little question that the brothers raise to Joseph about whether or not his forgiveness of them will endure. Will it endure after their father has died? Is Joseph's mercy, does it have any kind of transcendent dimension to it. And he speaks to them about God's mercy. And that gift, the gifts that flow once the matter of faith has been initiated, once it has had its power, once it acts, once it changes us. You see something of this, by the way, in a reading from the second letter of Peter, where the transformation that faith brings into play has this tremendous capacity to transform all of human life completely, and links everyone, and links the soul in its order of faith to God. Simon Peter, servant and apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who have received a faith as precious as our own, given through the saving justice of our God and Savior Christ, Jesus Christ, grace and peace be yours in abundance through the knowledge of our Lord. By his divine power, he has lavished on us all things we need for life and for true devotion, through the knowledge of him who has called us by his own glory and goodness. Through these, the greatest and priceless promises have been lavished on us, that through them you should share the divine nature and escape the corruption rife in the world through disordered passion. With this in view, do your utmost to support your faith with goodness. Goodness with understanding. Understanding with self-control. Self-control with perseverance. Perseverance with devotion. Devotion with kindness to the brothers. And kindness to the brothers with love. The possession and growth of these qualities will prevent your knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ from being ineffectual or unproductive. But without them, a person is blind or short-sighted, forgetting how the sins of the past were washed away. Instead of this, brothers, never allow your choice or calling to waver. Then there will be no danger of your stumbling. For in this way, you will be given the generous gift of entry to the eternal kingdom of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This that is in that epistle speaks to us. This is, in a sense, is the anthropology that comes from the gift of faith. It's a shaping of one's complete interiority, in which all the different dimensions of the human subject, of human consciousness, of human knowledge, of human imagination, of human action, of human freedom, of human openness to the constant gifts of divine love and mercy are available. And finally, there is the gift that flows from all of those. When all of those are rightly ordered to the gift of faith, then there is the openness to the gift of the eternal kingdom. The fulfillment, the final stage, the stage of finality that comes at the very conclusion of the fullness of all things in God. So I think one of the things that becomes important for us, and we can go through other people's accounts in the scriptures to do this, to talk about the way in which this matter of the unfolding of faith is so important. Now, one of the things that is important for the year of faith, it seems to me, because the Pope in his report and also in his Christmas allocution to the Curia speaks of this very same matter, which he wrote in Porta Fide in October of 2011. So now in December he speaks again to them about it, and he relates it to these very practical kinds of things that he has seen during this year that he has been engaged with his mission as a shepherd. And he tells them about the importance of the, particularly he focused on the World Youth Day in Madrid, and the and all of the little stages of finality that had to go into preparing for that, and all the people who did various and sundry things in order to be able to make this come to play, and then to see what the consequences of this are in the matter of being able to have so many young people open their hearts to God, to be able to understand the importance of gratitude. Of gratitude, which of course is the celebration of the Eucharist, the Thanksgiving, which we, because of our nature, cannot provide the kind of thanksgiving that God really requires. Only God can give to God the kind of thanksgiving that is a fulfilling response to what the gift actually is itself. Now, so the Pope goes through these matters, and he then gives also some suggestions about the ways in which these things relate back to what he had suggested, rather, in the October document, Porta Fidei, of the ways in which dioceses, parishes, and so forth can be preparing for this matter of the year of faith. Now, I think that one of the things that becomes very important to us, first of all, is this matter of witness. The year of faith is a year, first of all, of an awakening of the depth of what it is to have received this gift, and the way in which, in different manners, we bring that gift forward in the church. In that wonderful account in 2 Peter, you hear the way in which the relationship between faith and understanding, between faith and goodness or the moral order, between faith and perseverance, all the dimensions of the virtues all coming into play. So in different ways, we bring these testimonies. And I just want to say that there is something very interesting that I have found among the young people who are in the seminaries these days, and not only those men, but also people who are involved in the campus ministry programs. And certainly what I recognized, because I was for 30 years professor of theology and then of Catholic studies at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we created there, which now is in its 15th year, the Catholic Studies program, because the Catholic University itself had no way of being able to allow any kind of testimony of faith to be engaging the young people in the sense of their learning, their sense of knowing a wisdom tradition, their sense of being able to link prayer to their studies, the sense of being able to give witness to the other students on the campus was amazing. After we had this program going for 3.5 years, what we had found was that so dried up had everything become in the university that the only people who were actually teaching anything Catholic or trying to give witness to anything Catholic were the elderly priests who were the members of the faculty, most of whom were no longer teaching, but would write these letters to the president or to the campus ministry office saying, why are you doing this sort of thing? This has nothing to do with, this is an antagonist, this is contradictory to what the church teaches, what it wants our young people to know. As it would write out letters of how to have safe sex while you are off on your vacation at Easter time, okay? Things like that. The only ones talking were us. Within 3.5 years, the whole thing was turned around. The whole thing was turned around because now it wasn't just 7 or 8 little tired old priests writing letters. Now there were 350, 450, 550 kids 18 to 21 who were out there being true. This is the kind of thing, and that's why the community becomes so, that's the family, okay? And these people, there's nothing perfect about these people, but they have a knowledge of God. And they have a knowledge of the way in which God actually is at work in their lives. You have no idea how many vocations both to priesthood and religious life have come through that program. So, the fact is, when there is this ability to support young people in this matter, they have an ability that you and I don't really have, I suspect. Well, I shouldn't say, because I'm older than most of you. Younger people have a much greater ability to give witness. And it comes frequently from having friends in the evangelical communities. And we see this all the time. And it's not only what one can see in seminaries, but what one can see in the way in which young people in campus ministry places talk to one another about God, the way they seek to convince one another about what they have experienced, what they know, what they love, why it is they love what they do. So there is this, as a matter of fact, a broad set of possibilities that grace has already been at work before we get to this year. Now, one of the great problems that we all face in some sense is that the great tradition that we have, I want to talk about two things of it, the relationship of grace and nature and not faith and knowledge. First, grace and nature. One of the great difficulties of the present time is, and this is something that I see always now in the ecumenical dialogues. In fact, I brought with me an essay that was written by Christopher Dawson in 1933 called The Patriarchal Family in History, which in 1933 already can envision. Because Dawson was a man of extraordinary faith, and he had this great sense of the concreteness, the details of culture. And that was one of the things he used to be scornful about, us not being adequately engaged in and history, the importance of history and the importance of culture. The concreteness of the way in which the God's providential light, presence is always at work. But now, and you see in these dialogues, there is no longer any agreement on nature. What is human nature? And so therefore, we get into these great big questions within the framework of both our Protestant relations and then also with our culture then, regarding the issues of same-sex marriage and so forth. That it simply, they simply create deformation of the order of the naturals. Now, grace, we always say, elevates nature. And indeed, but the problem is that when naturing itself is not properly protected, guided, taught, supported, then grace has to do not only its own work of the elevation, it has to do this other prior work of trying to find ways to purify the very way in which nature itself is deforming itself. So that's one thing that we need to find ways to recover what is part of our creatureliness. Our creatureliness that in which there is a prevenient grace, as we now hear in our masses, prevenient grace, which is basically the Holy Spirit that is opening up in the same way we could say about the soul of Abraham having a certain kind of natural quest. There is a certain kind of grace which has a universality to it. And then the graces that come through the life of Christ and the church builds upon the prevailing graces and add to those graces again and again and again, so many different ways. So we have, for example, am on the, and we'll be leaving in May for the second meeting of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, its third round, which is on the church as koinonia in its universal and local structures, and then also the question of what are the ethical results of the church as koinonia in its universal and local manifestations. But we have no agreement on what nature is. And so it's very difficult stuff. Okay, so the other one is faith and reason, and I want to talk about that because there's something that we need to think about here, because and I want to draw upon some insights and distinctions made by Bernard Lonergan when he in the way in which he talks about the relationship of faith and belief. You'll notice in the papal statement there is a constant using of faith and belief interchangeably. And the issue that we need to have is that the act of faith, first of all, has its presence within us as a subjective undertow of God's love, which is constantly calling us to deeper, deeper conversions. And that undertow is something that is taking place within our own interiority. And what names that gift fully, that conversion fully, is the objectivity of what faith presents us. This is why the Pope talks about the Catechism as being so important. It's the way we can bring the objective understanding of the Church's tradition, the understanding its understanding of the mystery in which it dwells to people who live within our time and who have built into them many, many resistances, as we can see even recently in some of the campaign issues in our own country. Now, one of the matters then that Lonergan makes, he distinguishes belief as something that is absolutely essential to ordinary knowing. So it's not something that occurs only when we say, I believe in relationship to the creed. But Lonergan's basic position is that belief is a judgment that is made that permits us to have a great sociological advance in knowledge. Because we can't all repeat absolutely everything that everybody has ever done in order to say we know something. So most of our knowledge, he says, really is based on belief. So belief is not something that is just present in religion. Belief is essential for the entire human project of developing and of providing what is needed in order to be able to have even the unfolding of sciences. But we simply don't have the time. We would never advance at all without this matter of belief. So I think this is a very important thing, because if we use our kind of analogical understanding about the relationship of faith and belief, we can begin to recognize that acts of belief are not just unique to Christian existence. And let me tell you something quite interesting. Who are the people that we see more and more coming to think of themselves as having vocations to the priesthood? Where do their undergraduate degrees coming in? They're coming in engineering and the natural sciences. Areas where the act of belief in relationship to knowledge is absolutely required. You don't start worrying about a hermeneutic of suspicion when you're building a bridge. Because if you do, it'll be like the one out in Minneapolis. But I think that's an important thing for us to consider, because when we begin to talk about the relationship of faith and knowledge, we need to be able to provide access to people to indicate how it is that what we're talking about is not as strange as they may think it is. The second thing and final thing here would be the importance of the parables. The parables are the ways in which the relationship of human understanding and faith are most radically presented. And what is the great thing? What are the parables doing? Their parables are preparing people for Christ. They're preparing people to be able to recognize him in his death and resurrection. Because the ordinary way in which we work, human nature works this way. Like when we're little children, we have questions, 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 and we're looking for understanding. That's the first pattern that human consciousness has. And the difficulty is that we want to use that pattern in the same way when we hear the word of revelation, or when we experience the mystery of grace, or when we know the presence of God. And the problem is what the parables are telling us is this. You have to bracket the ordinary way of learning. You have to bracket that and allow faith to make the first step. Then can come the understanding. What is Jesus doing with all of the ways in which he prepares the... I mean, look at what he does with Peter's confession. Peter's confession is this great outburst of faith, immediately contrived back into a system in which he's going to explain how a Messiah ought to be, based upon his understanding. No, a Messiah must never suffer. So this tension between faith and understanding is something we need to have a grasp of within ourselves so that we can help others to understand it and to see how in the scriptures themselves the mystery of this relationship of faith and reason takes place. So, the year of faith, I think, is very crucial for us. And I would say the difficulties that all of us face, and I remember beginning to come aware of these. Students always get concerned when I start telling them about Flannery O'Connor, because I do it most every conference. But why is Flannery O'Connor so important? Because Flannery O'Connor, back in the 1950s, saw the problem already. She said, "I write from the viewpoint of the incarnation, and no one believes in the incarnation any longer." What is it that people do not have available to them anymore that Flannery O'Connor had recognized back then? There's a book by R.W.B. Lewis, was written in 1955, called The American Adam. He was a professor, literary professor at Yale. The story of The American Adam is how Protestantism in America in the middle of the 19th century underwent this violent kind of uproaring attack upon the extreme forms of Calvinism that Puritanism and some of the other Calvinistic traditions had, in which everything was a sin. And the Unitarian position came forth and, in fact, overthrew the Harvard faculty of 1804 in the theology department of the Divinity School and replaced it with this what is called the School of Hope. And the School of Hope basically is there is no sin. There's nothing to be redeemed from. And if there is nothing to be redeemed from, then nobody has the kind of question that would awaken their sense about the gratitude that is needed for this relationship to the mystery of God's goodness and mercy. So why mercy? When the American Adam, when confronted with a problem, simply gets in his car and drives away. Because that's the way these stories, and you read these, he has this wonderful thing of these short stories and novels. This was all carried out, not so much by the theologians, but by the literary people of the 19th century. It's what Americans were reading, not just Protestants, but Catholics. And now we have imbibed this vision. And I would say this is one of the most important resistors to faith in the Catholic tradition, and something that we all need to know about, and that we need to reawaken the recognition of sin and evil not only in our world, but in ourselves. Then we can know more about the mystery of God's gift of faith. So, thank you. I think what I'll do is stop here, and I'd be willing to have, if anyone has any comments or questions or additional insights, I think that we could share together, that would be. Is that the correct time?
20 minutes, that's a little fast. Yeah, that's fast. So we've got about 20 minutes for questions.
Okay, absolutely. Yes.
Who are some of these authors?
Hawthorne would be one, for example. Thoreau, Emerson. Those would be a few of the major ones. There are a lot of minor ones who I don't remember now, but certainly those would be some of the major people who, Emerson and Thoreau, were part of the Unitarian School of Hope, and the absolute loss of any sense of transcendence. And basically, Emerson particularly, had been involved in the appropriation of the European Enlightenment, particularly the German form of it, which basically eliminated any sense. Part of the thing that the Enlightenment does is what it really despised was about Christianity. It despises the notion, and of course this then goes directly to the Jews. It despises the notion that there's a chosen people, or that there is because fairness demands that everybody has to have the same possibilities for them. And what faith and grace speak about is unique, particular gifts that individuals have, and that's simply unfair. So it's called, the Enlightenment calls it, in some phases, it calls itself the prejudice against prejudice.
I can remember Joseph Ratzinger speaking about this question of the seeming unfairness of God choosing certain individuals and a whole people. Mm-hmm. When I heard him in Munster, he was still less, under 40. Mm-hmm. And I can remember his saying that when God chooses one person or a people, it's always for the sake of other people who are not chosen, but through him or her will be chosen.
Exactly. But that's never seen. Yes.
A comment and a question. A comment is regarding the Life Team program regarding personal witness is very much in line with what you're talking about, mm-hmm. Your Excellency. It's involved, many, many parishes have it, and mm-hmm. the young people get used to witnessing to one another regarding their faith and bringing their friends to church, etc. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very good. Question is, you have a specific citation for Lonergan where he speaks about this necessity of belief even in science.
Yes, it's the best place for location would be in Method in Theology. The chapter, I believe it's the chapter on within the framework of setting up the structure of consciousness. I think it may be the chapter on meaning. I think it's a chapter on meaning, maybe chapter 3, I think. But you could go, if you go back to the list in the back, you will see the references to it there too.
Yeah.
But he speaks of it also in insight, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Two questions, and you might not be able to say too much, I don't know. When you mentioned about Joseph realizing that the gift needs to be appreciated and stored or saved, to what extent it's probably just a prudential judgment in any kinds of gifts or to build up a reservoir that overflows, but to what extent do you need to store and save gifts, and to what extent do you have to actually let them pass through you and give them away so that you don't become attached to them and accumulate them? That's one question. The other question was,
it's a good question, but in the sense that that's exactly why the gifts were saved, was to give them away. They weren't being saved just to hoard. They were being saved because there would be the need of the people to be able to continue to have sufficient food for their living. And indeed, not only did they have enough apparently for them, but they would also, others could come and buy grains and so forth as they needed them. So, yeah, I mean, it is a prudential judgment. And it's also one that has to be able to base itself upon a fairly good set of insights into the situation in which the gifts are made available. I think I can remember maybe a somewhat related issue. It's a very strange thing about the way in which Catholics used to extend charity within the church. I mean, and the difference between, say, the secular society and the Protestant world. If you go to, say, Creighton University, and you look at the buildings, and the buildings are all named for people who were priests, Jesuit priests of the university, who had no money themselves. Now, so the people gave just out of the sense of the way in which the church had a need, and the church would build itself up as it needed to respond to situations. Now, just like the secular people and the Protestants, Catholics want to have the buildings named after them. The whole sense of what does it mean to have a charity that's for the whole community versus to have my name engraved in stone? There's a big difference there.
I think also in Sean's thing, Bernard Clavaux wrote a sermon in the Song of Songs, Sermon 21, talks beautifully about the reservoir of the gift and at what point we do relinquish that gift. So that's a good thing to look at.
Thank you.
I was, your reflection on Joseph, the story of Joseph, and kind of the clash of the cosmogonic and the Jewish worldviews I was thinking about the novel The Edge of Sadness, about the Boston priest who's an alcoholic, who's kind of...
Right.
And thinking about the way in which in that older culture, the people took a priest who was fallen and brought him and kind of tried to rehabilitate him, bring him back, and how oftentimes in our culture today, including in the Catholic culture, we're taking people who are fallen, distancing ourselves from them so that they're kind of the way that the brothers did. You know, if we get them out of our way, then our life will be back, will be under control again. I'm wondering if you think that might be something, another area where we are adopting the corporate practices.
I think so, and I think one of the great dangers that we face is that statistics indicate that the number of priests who actually participate in the sacrament of penance is very, very small. I think this is really this is the scandal behind the scandal in some sense. Because we don't understand mercy. We don't realize the way in which our own fallenness needs and requires the church. And then we don't know how to be the church to others who are in those situations. This very frightening statement, going back to the matter of your faith, the chief psychiatrist at Mass General, who did a lot of the interviews of people who had been involved in abuses, and he said that he was absolutely astounded that the vast majority of them had no faith. That's pretty frightening.
You mean their faith had been destroyed by the abuse, or...?
Well, that they had... I don't know what destroyed it, but they had... In other words, faith would have had them been able to see the vision between what they were doing and what they were claiming to be.
Oh, you mean the perpetrators had
yes.
faith? I thought you said the victims.
No, the perpetrators, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned early on the lack of gratitude today.
Yes.
And I've noticed that. Young people don't say thank you. I think they're just, it's owed to them. I was brought up differently. My mother died when I was 6 and a half. I'm the oldest of 3 children. I can remember my Anglican priest father on Christmas Day when he was opening his present, our present, saying, "Stop! No child opens another present until I have written this down." And he kept a list for every child of every present and from whom it was received, and we had to write thank you letters in the next couple of days.
Of course, yes.
That doesn't happen anymore.
No. But that, you see, that's the way a culture changes when you don't have gratitude within the religious world. It simply disappears then eventually from the world of ordinary experience as well.
But how can we encourage people to be grateful today?
Well, I think first of all we have to get them to be aware of what is actually their relationship to the world of gift, and they don't understand that. Now, that's why faith is so weak. Is that we don't have an adequate account or an adequate experience about the way in which we are recipients of graces. We're recipients. I mean, the whole celebration of the Triduum is an entire rendering of the mystery. It's an encapsulation of the whole of the mystery of divine gift and gratitude. And so, one of the things that, let me go back to Flannery O'Connor. O'Connor's great line was that, and she wrote, the title of her essays is called Mystery and Manners. And manners are the ordinary human ways of being able to be prepared for the understanding of the mystery of gift. We don't have manners sufficient now. This is one of the things, this is what I mean by grace having to supply what nature ordinarily would have supplied before.
When you said this is the Lore of the Gift, it made me think of a book by Lewis Hyde.
Oh, I read that, yes. I used to use that in my classes.
Seems along these same lines, the anthropology of the,
yes,
of the gift.
Yes, gift exchange versus the exchange of
trying to possess it.
The possession world, yeah, right.
I'd like to explore a little bit more your point on Jesus' use of parables really as the gateway to faith. Mm-hmm. I was stunned and a little bit disappointed with what the CDF put out in terms of the practical ways to mark this year of faith, because it was totally uncreative,
yeah,
and boring. And, you know, I mean, when you look at the Second Vatican Council documents and you look at the Catechism, for all its strengths, there aren't a heck of a lot of parables and aren't a heck of a lot of images there. And I'm wondering what you would think the practical consequences would be learning from and imitating what Jesus himself did to open up faith in terms of how we're able to communicate it. Is it just trying to stimulate other writers like Flannery O'Connor to be able to use images to pass on the truths of faith in an incarnational way? Or are there other things that you're thinking about too?
Well, I think part of it is the way we preach has to have include more and more images. Let me give you an example of a wonderful, this was an image, but image taken from history. Cardinal Wyszynski made a decision when he was the Archbishop of Warsaw that he put forth something to all the seminaries in Poland, saying that in every single homily, the priest was to give an historical example of the way in which the church had been involved in the shaping of Polish culture. And that's what they did. And so they had this array of historical examples over against the Marxist claims that the church had done nothing but destroy people and that the Marxism was going to save the church and so forth. So, we need to reacquire. You know, there's a wonderful essay published in Thought magazine back in 1956 called The Death of the Imagination by Elizabeth Sewell. She was a British writer who had come to the United States and taught, I think, in, maybe at Fordham. No, we need to recover the images. We need to find ways to open up people's sensibilities to the way in which this vast world of meaning can provide us with a certain... I mean, you can't understand the Bible without all of these. The Bible is filled with these. Mm-hmm. And then you have the translations of these into the culture for centuries. So they're there. And then the lives of saints. I mean, the images of martyrs and so on and so forth. I think you have to get to children particularly with these images. Because children have, at certain points particularly, and I think Maria Montessori, but by the way, which one of the things I want to do in the Archdiocese of Boston is to bring Montessori. Montessori, as you all know, her whole vision was for Catholic catechesis. That's what her whole sense of getting children to be able to move along and learn and so on and so forth. And people like Piaget, who worked with her, became disenchanted with the whole religious dimension and faith dimension of it, and went off on their own and did their stuff in Switzerland and so forth. But Montessori has this wonderful thing about getting little children to be attentive to the instruments of the Mass. Handle them, little wooden things, they make these kits, and you just let them have questions. And they'll imagine if you give them a sufficient kind of range of experiences that they can begin to work with.
Elizabeth Ansgar can teach them transubstantiation.
Yes, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes. It seems in a culture which exalts in entitlements and the talk of rights,
yes,
seems deaf to the language of the gift.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And that's the Enlightenment language. It's the language of rights as opposed to the language of preferences that come through gifts. But the fact of the matter is, when people love one another, they give each other gifts. You know. So you can, I think what we need to do is we need to heighten heighten their attention to the relationship between gifts and the experiences of sacrifice and the experiences of people's love and care. And they have to learn that they have to make sacrifices in order to be able to allow gifts to be made available to others.
St. Vincent de Paul said that if you don't love your people, they will never forgive you for the bread that you give them, which I thought was very interesting.
It is, yes.
And we live in a culture of entitlement which, you know, the bureaucrat doesn't love the people that he's writing checks.
That's right, no. There's nothing there. It's just a, you know, I think one of the things that's unfortunate is we got ourselves caught up in what had been a work of charity that the church had with its hospitals and its and forms of care for the sick and the elderly and the prisons and so forth, and it ran off of federal monies, and there we killed in a sense the gift that is at the core of the way the church meets the darkness of the world.
Yeah, Excellency, going back to your reference to Fire upon it and the Incarnation, I remember Fulton Sheen writing about 50 years ago about this, this, if you will, tension in the church for centuries between an emphasis on the divinity of Christ at the expense of his humanity, or an overemphasis on his humanity at the expense of his divinity. And that what we were into in the 70s was an overemphasis on the humanity of Christ at the expense of his divinity.
Mm-hmm.
And if the church did not do something to check that, what would happen is the denial of the Incarnation, and then which would lead to a denial of the real presence,
mm-hmm.
which I think we can see definitely taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could, I think I see the pendulum swinging back a little bit now, especially considering the group I'm here with today. But the effects of that on the life of the church and the clergy, of course, the people of God, I mean,
yes,
all around us.
Well, it's absolutely true, and I think the problem, you see it in if you want to get little images of that, where you can still see how it's operating, you look at parish bulletins, which basically announce, we welcome everybody, see, wherever you are. We welcome people in order to bring them to forgiveness, to conversion. That's why we welcome people. So the transcendent dimension, or what in terms of the divinity of Christ, is left out, and you just get this humanity in which all you're doing... You know, there was a wonderful... Robert Coles, I don't know if you ever read him, he used to write in a little piece called The Harvard Diary. It was in the little magazine that came out monthly called The Oxford Review. And I remember one time reading it, and he had this story about a doctor who was in Boston who was a daily communicant. And he was very ill, and he was at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and a priest came to see him, and Coles had gone in maybe 2 hours after the priest had been there, and the doctor was livid. Okay. And he said, well, what's the problem? He said, you know what? He said, all he wanted to know was, he started giving me a psychological examination. I wanted something spiritual. I wanted to hear about God.
Right.
And he's telling me about, oh, my health, your health will be better, and blah, 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 blah. He said, I'm ready for him the next time when he comes in. I said, because I'm going to give him a psalm, and I'm going to say to him, Father, tell me what this means.
Good for him.
That's the problem.
Thank you.
Thanks.